to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 19th of October, 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. It's the beginning of another week, and we have some news stories to discuss, and who better to discuss them with than Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good afternoon, sir. How are you doing?
Good afternoon to you. Yes, I'm very well indeed, and looking forward to our chat this afternoon. I think we've got some good stuff lined up, and it should be an interesting time.
Yes, well, we've certainly got a really good Greatest Britain to talk about later on. I mean, it's just about got everything in the story that we're going to be getting into. But before we get into that, I noticed today that they have unveiled a new 50p coin. And this new coin has Diversity Built Britain emblazoned across it. And the government say, because this is actually reported from the UKGov.org site, it says a new coin to mark the profound contribution minority communities have made to the shared history of the United Kingdom will enter circulation next week. Around 2.5 million of the 50p coins, which recognise and celebrate Britain's diverse history, will be released on Monday. The coin features a geodome, which represents a community of connection and strength, with each section working together to build something greater. And of course, there are two points that we can really highlight about this. How did diversity build Britain? We didn't really have any immigration into the country until about 70 years ago. Up until then, it was all European immigration. So I would like to see what their contribution is. Why do they say that this is a shared history? Britain's history is Britain's history. It is the history of the British people. Any history that is associated with the newcomers is only the history of the last 70 years. That's our shared history with these other peoples, just the last 70 years. And Britain was not built within 70 years. And the final point about this is what they have chosen to represent diversity is a geodesic dome, which is made up of all equal-sized triangles. Now, if this was supposed to represent diversity, the triangles would all be different sizes, or instead of being triangles, they would be different shapes. And you can't build a geodesic dome out of different shapes or different size triangles. What they actually have here is a structure that is built from homogeneous shapes, showing that homogeneous shapes bring strength. The coin itself shows us that diversity is not a strength, it is a weakness. And if you want to have strength, you have to build something out of exactly the same shaped blocks, triangles, or whatever. I mean, it's just incredible that that's what they've chosen to actually show how much they want to celebrate diversity. I'm amazed at the stupidity of it, to be honest. But what do you make of this new coin here, Max?
Well, this is another part of the increasing display of wokeness on the part of the government, basically, and on the part of public institutions, where they are responding to the death of George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter campaign by creating really what are quite insulting, platitudinous kind of things, and there are lots of elements that have been introduced into our media in recent months, which are of a similar kind, where they are promoting diversity. And as you say, it's absurd because if you have diverse things, then you create an irregular shape that that very often is useless. And I think the thing that sort of proves the lie in all of this is that wherever in the world there has been a high technology society like we have created here in Britain, wherever there is such a high technology society, it was created in a monoracial and monocultural country. There isn't a single country in the world where the population is made up of diverse communities where there has been a civilization like ours created, because if diversity did create that sort of thing, and The people who promote diversity keep telling us how the DNA of the people of Africa is more diverse than the DNA of the rest of the world. And this is apparently evidence used to show that Homo sapiens originated first of all in Africa. Then with all of this massive diversity that exists genetically within Africa, we would have expected to see civilizations on the scale of high technology civilizations of the type that we see in Europe. We would expect to have seen those springing up spontaneously all over Africa. And of course, they didn't do that. And that is what shows the lie in all of this. If we go to India, well, more of the civilization was created in India, but the civilization was weak because it was made up of lots and lots of little tiny principalities. And in the absence of European intervention, India never united. It only united under the influence of the British Raj, whereas as far as Britain is concerned, these isles, which were originally composed of a very large number of tribal homelands, eventually united into one united kingdom. If you look at France, if you go back into the 1700s and the 1600s, was a mass of principalities and small states, as was Germany, as was Italy, as was Turkey, for that matter. And all of those countries went through a process of unification and did that under their own steam. It was, but the countries where there were large numbers of principalities that persisted into the 17th and 18th and 19th centuries, they were the ones that were weak, and the ones that were so racked with internal dissension and internal conflict that they fell before the European invaders very, very easily.
Well, you don't see diversity actually building anything. In history, we see diversity being the cause of the downfall of great civilizations. So we can think of Babylon there, and that was built by the original Babylonians. And as soon as it was filled up with different peoples and it became an empire, it fell apart because they all started interbreeding together. It's the same story with Egypt, the great Egyptian civilization. They started allowing foreigners in. They made them into citizens. They started interbreeding with them, and the civilization fell apart. It's never built anything. A house that is divided against itself shall not stand. So how can it be used to build anything? You can say that diversity of thought is a good thing, and it has been shown in studies that if you have people with the same IQ, with the same qualifications, and they have different upbringings, then you might get novel ideas from that. But that is diversity of thought, with everybody starting with the same qualifications and the same merit. What we have here, what they're trying to promote, is just diversity for diversity's sake. So what they mean is different races, different genders, different sexualities, which is a recipe for chaos, basically. It's not a recipe for success. It's not a recipe for building a solid structure, which they try to show with this geodome. They even try to say that this geodome represents diversity. It doesn't represent diversity at all. It represents the complete opposite of that. And why aren't they celebrating the history of our British ancestors that actually built Britain? How about we have a day when we just celebrate the amazing structures, the amazing architecture, the beautiful shaped landscapes that we have in the country, all these wonderful things we have around us that were actually built by our ancestors? Why are we not celebrating that? Why are we trying to include other peoples in this who have only been here recently in the last 70 years, who, when they talk about a shared history, what they mean is things like slavery, and trying to guilt trip us into thinking that we oppressed these other peoples throughout the rest of the world rather than help them? I mean, we will see later on when we get to our Greatest Britain that in actual fact, we really helped these people in a massive way. And I did a podcast on Friday to do with slavery again, which showed that this was This was quite a benign institution, and the people that were involved in it saw it as that they were actually helping the poor and the indigent, and at the same time, they were actually providing them employment. This idea that they were mistreated, that may have happened in very small cases, a small amount of the time, the same as you would get mistreated today in employment. And yet these people, these newcomers that have come to our countries today, that's what they mean by history. That's what they mean by black history. And what they will try to do is they will try to insert these newcomers into historical programs on the BBC. They'll try to insert them into our history. Wherever there's mention of Africa in our history, where it's talking about the Carthaginians, or it's talking about the Vandals, or it's talking about the Romans who are in North Africa, what they will try to do today is they will try to claim that those people were in actual fact sub-Saharan Negroes, which is just not true. So these are various ways that they're actually trying to distort our history. They're trying to twist our history. And what it all boils down to is stealing our heritage from us, stealing our identity from us and giving it to another people and telling them that they are British just because they have a British passport, regardless of their ancestral heritage, which could have come from anywhere else in the world. And so it's just a huge, great theft that is going on, and a falsity here with this coin where they're trying to celebrate this. One good thing could come out of this, and that is when you get those coins and when you see those coins, you can point some of these things out to people and say, well, look what's going on here. What do they mean? Diversity built Britain, where they've got a geodesic dome, which only holds its strength because it doesn't have diversity, because it has homogeneity. So at least it could be a conversation starter onto some of these subjects, I think. Mm. I don't want to add any more to that, Max.
No, I think we've pretty well covered that.
Well, I wanted to get into another subject as well. Over the weekend, I saw that there were pictures that were going up of stickers that have been put up all around Golders Green. And Golders Green is a majority Jewish part of London. I'm not sure if it's 99% Jewish or something like that, but it's where all the Jews live, basically, in London. And a lot of stickers have been put up on lampposts, and the stickers say, small hats equals big problem. And the small hats had a Jewish star on them, so it's quite obvious who they're talking about. It's quite obvious that this is to do with the YouTube streaming community, because that's their terminology, referring to the Jews as small hats. The stickers themselves, it was quite clear that they came from the Hundred Handers, which are known for being an ethno-nationalist organization. They're decentralized. Nobody knows who they are. People could just print these stickers off. And I saw this and I was quite alarmed at this, because I thought, well, let's think about this. What is the point of this? Are we trying to red pill the Jews? Who is our target audience? Our target audience is white people. So why are stickers being put up outside Jews' houses? This just seemed to me like a deliberate attempt to antagonize the Jews there. I mean, the law is that we're not allowed to incite hatred, and we're not supposed to cause offence. Well, this is deliberately done to cause offence, and it can be said that it's displaying a hatred for these Jews that live there. It's intimidating these Jews within their own homes, none of which is a good thing. I mean, you could say that an extreme example of this might be putting swastikas on Jewish gravestones. What we've got here is putting stickers on lampposts outside Jews' houses. So that's one reason why I don't think this is a good idea. And the second reason is because very recently there was a big news report and a big Hope Not Hate report identifying somebody as being behind the Hundred Handers. It was very, very public. So you know that the police have got their eye on this fellow, and they will be doing all they can to try and find some evidence or find something that they can use to throw at him. And now here we have all these stickers that have been put up outside these Jews' houses. It just seemed to me like it was a gift to the police if they wanted to go and arrest this chap, and they could blame him for this. Now, I'm not saying that this was deliberately done like that. I mean, it could have been MI5 doing that because they wanted an excuse to go after this guy. Now, is this stretching things too far? Well, I don't think it is, because if we look back in our history, we don't have to go too far back. And there was an incident with Simon Shepherd, who was an author and a publisher, and he's a publisher of Heretical Publishing and heretical.com. You can check his website out. And he published a comic called Tales of the Hollow Hoax. And this comic had been around for about 20 years. It was an underground comic, just humor, basically, that highlighted inconsistencies in the gas chamber narrative. And some anonymous person thought it would be a very, very good idea to post one of these comics to one of the rabbis in Golders Green, I think it was. And because of that, because this comic got posted to this rabbi was very upset by this, and he told the police about it. And the end of the story was Simon Shepherd got about 7 years in prison. And it wasn't the person that posted the comic that got the prison sentence. It was the publisher of the comic that got the prison sentence. A second instance like this would be National Action, who are now banned. Before National Action were banned, they went to Golders Green and they draped swastika flags over the lampposts around a park there at Golders Green. This caused a lot of alarm, obviously. The Jews there felt very intimidated. And 6 months later, we see that National Action have been prohibited as a terrorist organization. And since then, we've had numbers of young people that have been jailed for seemingly endless jail sentences for multiple years for no actual violent crime, but just for associating with each other in most cases. And all of these things have come about from just antagonizing Jews. Why antagonize these ethnic minorities? It is not going to cause any positive for us. It means that the person who does it is most likely to be investigated. They're most likely to get a prison sentence. It means other people, such as the publisher of the stickers, the guy that dreamt up the stickers, he could then get punished for this. We could see more censorship. We could see people lose their channels on YouTube, people lose their websites, people lose their Twitter. And for what? It's not going to bring anybody to our cause whatsoever. All it does is produce sympathy for these Jews who are effectively being intimidated within their own homes. So I completely condemn this. I can see why people do it. They think, oh, well, this is funny. This would be getting one over on them. But it's not getting one over on them. It's just giving us a bad name. And I was very upset to see that people had actually done this. I really thought that, I don't know if it was anyone from within our community, but I had thought that our community was a little bit more sensible than that. And I have seen some people from our community thinking this was a good thing. And I really don't think it was. But have you got any comments that you'd like to add to that, Max?
I think I generally agree with you that from a tactical or strategic point of view, doing this kind of thing is just counterproductive. There is no point making individual Jewish families feel anxious and feel that they're under threat. That isn't going to achieve anything other than make those people even more ethnocentrically orientated and even more paranoid about things that nationalist organisations do, because the blame always comes back to nationalism in general for these things taking place. This is what the media and our political establishment do and what they want. There is lots of good work that we need to do in terms of building up the white communities of Britain, reuniting the peoples of the British Isles. There's lots of constructive work that we need to do, and we could very well get on with without wasting our time just irritating and aggravating ethnic minorities unnecessarily.
Well, I think there's also positive propaganda and there is negative propaganda. Positive propaganda would be it's okay to be white. White lives matter. Love your people. Positive things that are pro-white, that are talking about white people. And then there is negative propaganda, which is like this: small hats equals big problem. And that is not, I don't think that is going to bring people to our side. An audacious thing like flying a White Lives Matter banner over the Burnley football ground, that's going to bring people to our side. That is a positive statement that has been made there. And when people deny that positive statement, they look terrible. I mean, just look at the way that all the TV pundits looked when they said, oh, this is dreadful, because the general people see that and say, what do you mean? It's not okay. to be white. But when general people see things like small hats equals big problem with a Jewish star on it, their sympathy is with the Jews. It isn't with the person that put those stickers up. It doesn't benefit us in any way. We need to be reaching out to other white people and not trying to intimidate these ethnic minorities. And the other thing that comes from this is this is exactly the sort of thing that the Jews point to as the reason why they need to have security outside their schools, why they need to have their own Shomrim police force. You know, they get millions of pounds from the government to these security trusts that they have to provide security for the Jews. And the way they get that is by pointing to things like that. And they say, look, there's this feeling against us. People are directly targeting us. We need to have this protection. And they get given that protection. And this is the reason why. And as you pointed out there, Max, it also increases their own sense of ethnocentrism. So, you know, the rabbis might condemn this, but in a way it does them a favor because it says, yes, you are being discriminated against Jews. You do need to stick together with your other Jews. And yes, we do need security because look at this. You know, we've known for a long time that the whole anti-Semitism thing does benefit the Jews in that way. It increases their ethnocentrism. It's not of any benefit to us at all. Apart from maybe giving some people a giggle. But when you think about the long term effects that this could cause, and the way that it could also affect other people within the movement, other people who are prominent people in the movement whose heads are up above the parapet, they're the ones that will get hammered down for this if they're shown to have any link to it. And as I said, the hundred handers are linked with ethno-nationalism. They are linked particularly with our community. So it doesn't look good on us. And I don't think that was a good bit of activism. I would like to see more positive things like the White Lives Matter banner. And also the stickers. I mean, put the stickers in sensible places. Put them in places where you can put stickers. Don't vandalize public property. I believe you're not supposed to put stickers or fly posters up, but you can put them up on the council notice boards. There are notice boards that are placed all around the country where people can put up notices of fates and things that are going on locally. And I think that's probably the best place for putting these rather than on public property, and definitely not outside Jews' houses. It's just targeting them, as far as I see it. Do you want to add to that, Max? Anything else that you want to bring up?
Only that if you visit the Jewish Chronicle website or you visit the Jewish News website, they are overwhelmingly dominated by stories of persecution of Jews, either the real persecution of Jews or the imagined persecution of Jews. Nobody needs to make the Jewish community in this country more paranoid than it is at the moment. And so even if you thought that making them paranoid was a good thing, it was a waste of time, because they're already just about as paranoid as any community can get, really. As I say, that the websites are just full of stories where they interpret things that people have said and done in a way which is extremely or paranoid in the extreme, in my view, and we don't need to wind them up any more than that. Need to wind them up at all, in fact.
I mean, my view is Jews are Jews. They behave the way they do because that's inherently in their nature, and we can't condemn them for the way they behave. We certainly can't judge them for their actions, because we are not Jews. The only people we can judge for our actions are our own people, and that's who we need to be targeting. That's who we need to be recruiting. That's who we need to be targeting with our information, so that we don't fall for all the temptations, so that we don't go along with all the things that the Jews promote, which are of benefit to them. That's what we need to be doing, is teaching us not to get out bank loans, not to get involved in pornography, don't get involved in drugs, don't promote race mixing, don't promote immigration. And you can do all of that without intimidating Jews. You can just look at that and say, well, these things are of benefit to the Jews. And these are the sort of things that they've done in their history. And that is just the way that they are. They are a separate people to us, and we have no right to judge them for the way that they behave. You only have to look at the Talmud to see that they are a very, very different people to us. And by their own standards, they're not doing anything wrong. And it's the same with blacks. It's the same with all the ethnic minorities. By their own standards, they're not actually doing anything wrong. The people that are doing things wrong are our own people, because we invited these people here and we gave them equal rights with us. And our treacherous politicians are still inviting foreigners into our country. They're still not turning the boats around in the channel. And it's our politicians, who are still made up of the majority of our people, that are the ones that are at fault here. And they're just the same as us. So we have a right to judge them. We can judge them. We can judge them by our own standards, and we can say that they are doing wrong. So that's who we need to be targeting, not these peoples that are just doing what comes naturally to them and naturally taking advantage of what we have, unfortunately handed to them on a plate. Basically, it's us that need to change, not them, I think is what I'm saying. Well, shall we get into our Greatest Britain then, Max? I'm quite keen to get into this week.
Yes, let's do that.
Yeah, it's our Greatest Britain for this week is Charles George Gordon. And I came across him completely by surprise, just looking through, trying to find interesting people to do with the British Empire. And I think this one is absolutely fantastic. There's so much in this story. There's media manipulation, there's propaganda, there's an Islamic state, if you can believe that. The guy himself is really looking out for the best interests of the foreigners that he is among. He really does set a good example of what an officer in the British Empire was really like. He was against slavery. It shows you how barbaric the Chinese were and how we were really bringing them civilization. And he was really charitable as well. He liked to look after the poor kids that didn't have any education. And he gave away most of his money, actually, to charity. I mean, this was a really, really virtuous man. There's been a film made of him as well. It's called Khartoum, which is just to do with when he was actually in Khartoum and the Siege of Khartoum, and that he was played by Charlton Heston in that. And he was a huge hero to the British people as well. He certainly earns the title of a greatest Briton. Well, let's have a look at what happened to him. We'll have a brief summary of his life, first of all. Major General Charles George Gordon, CB, born 28th of January 1833, died 26th of January 1885, also known as Chinese Gordon, Gordon Pasha, and Gordon of Khartoum, was a British Army officer and administrator. He saw action in the Crimean War as an officer in the British Army. However, he made his military reputation in China, where he was placed in command of the Ever Victorious Army, a force of Chinese soldiers led by European officers. In the early 1860s, Gordon and his men were instrumental in putting down the Taiping Rebellion, regularly defeating much larger forces. For these accomplishments, he was given the nickname Chinese Gordon and honours from both the Emperor of China and the British. He entered the service of the Khedive of Egypt in 1873 with British government approval, and later became the Governor General of the Sudan, where he did much to suppress revolts and the local slave trade. Exhausted, he resigned and returned to Europe in 1880. A serious revolt then broke out in the Sudan, led by a Muslim fanatic religious leader and self-proclaimed Mahdi, Muhammad Ahmed. In early 1884, Gordon was sent to Khartoum with instructions to secure the evacuation of loyal soldiers and civilians and to depart with them. But in defiance of those instructions, after evacuating about 2,500 civilians, he retained a smaller group of soldiers and non-military men. In the build-up to battle, the two leaders corresponded, each attempting to convert the other to his faith, but neither would accede. And Gordon was actually put up as this Christ figure that was fighting against these Islamic devils as well. It really captured the imagination of the British public when this was going on. Besieged by the Mahdi's forces, Gordon then organised a citywide defence lasting almost a year that gained him the admiration of the British public, but not of the government, which had wished him not to become entrenched. Only when public pressure to act had become irresistible did the government, with reluctance, send a relief force, but unfortunately it arrived 2 days after the city had fallen and Gordon had been killed. Well, that's a summary of what happens, and we'll get into the details of this as we go. But have you got any comments you'd like to make on that introduction, Max?
Just really, in that brief introduction, we've already raised the issue of Gordon not necessarily following his orders to the letter. Now, I don't know whether he had initially been instructed not to defend Khartoum and that he had decided to defend Khartoum in defiance of those orders, or whether his orders were to evacuate the civilians, and he had then decided that in addition to evacuating the civilians, he would defend the city in the absence of any further instructions. And that's perhaps something that as we go through, more information will come to light. But I think that is a central aspect of Gordon's personality that is one of the things that made him popular amongst the public. The fact that he was a little bit of a what's the word I'm trying to think of here?
He was acting on his own initiative.
That's right, acting on his own initiative. Yes, definitely
acting on his own initiative a lot of the time. And yeah, the British public really did warm to him because of that. Well, let's start with his early life. Gordon was born in Woolwich, London, a son of Major General Henry William Gordon and Elizabeth Enderby Gordon. The men of the Gordon family had served as officers in the British Army for four generations, and as a son of a general, Gordon was brought up to be the fifth generation. The possibility that Gordon would pursue anything other than a military career seems never to have been considered by his parents, and all of Gordon's brothers also became officers in the army. So this was still a time when you would do the same thing that your parents did, and therefore each generation would get better at what they were doing, because they would learn from a child what they were going to be doing as an adult. I think this was a much better way of doing things than we have now, when people do different things to their parents and they have temping jobs. I mean, this is a time when you went into a trade and you had that trade for the whole of your life, and your children were taught to be brought up in that trade as well. And there was a lot more security in that, I think. Well, as a teenager and an army cadet, Gordon was known for his high spirits, a combative streak, and a tendency to disregard authority and the rules if he felt them to be stupid or unjust, a personality trait that held back his graduation by 2 years when teachers decided to punish him for flouting the rules. As an officer, Gordon showed strong charisma and leadership, but his superiors distrusted him on account of his tendency to disobey orders if he felt them to be wrong or unjust. A man of medium stature with striking blue eyes, the charismatic Gordon had the ability to inspire men to follow him anywhere. And there's quite a lot of mention of these striking blue eyes that he had. Everybody that met him mentioned that. And also about the fact that he was a highly moral man. If he felt something wasn't right, then he was just not going to do it. I mean, this man really did set a good example of being a charitable white man, basically. Wherever he went, everybody said this man just set the absolute perfect example of how a man should be. Do you want to comment on this, Max?
I think what you've said there sets the scene for what we're going to cover later. I think that, as I said earlier on, that Gordon has already been identified, and from what you've just said, identified again as somebody who is a bit of a maverick. I think that's something that people do find an attractive quality in people. They don't like people who slavishly follow orders. I much prefer somebody who is their own person and who has perhaps a bit of colour to their personality and introduces a bit of daring do into their lives.
I'm not sure if he actually purchased any of his promotions either. I think he earned most of his promotions. And I guess the fact that his family and all the generations of his family had been in the army as well, I'm sure that would have stood him in good stead. Anyway, people would have recognised his name and that he was from this family. Unlike the one that we covered last week, where he started from absolutely nothing and made his way up to being the governor general. Well, let's have a look at the Crimea here. In the 19th century, Russia was Britain's arch enemy, with many people in both nations seeing an ideological conflict between Russian autocracy and British democracy, and Gordon was anxious to fight in the Crimea. He was put to work in the siege of Sevastopol and took part in the assault of the Redan from the 18th of June to the 8th of September 1855. As a sapper, Gordon had to map out the Russian fortifications at the city fortress of Sevastopol, designed by the famous Russian military engineer Edward Totleben, a highly dangerous job that frequently put him under enemy fire and led to him being wounded for the first time when a Russian sniper put a bullet into him. On the 18th of June 1855, the besieging British and French armies began what was intended to be the final assault that would take Sevastopol, which began with a huge bombardment. As a sapper, Gordon was in a front-line trench where he was under intense fire. Men fell all around him, and he was forced to take cover so often that he was covered literally from head to toe with mud and blood. He would spend 34 consecutive days in the trenches around Sevastopol and earned a reputation as an able and brave young officer. And it was said at the British HQ that if you want to know what the Russians are up to, send for Charlie Gordon. So he's already making a name for himself here, and we can see what it was like. I mean, this was really gritty work in the trenches here, and he'd taken on a particularly dangerous job. He was really fearless. In actual fact, later on in his life, we learned that he never actually carried any weapons. He would just carry a rattan cane. And he really sort of trusted in the Lord that he would protect him, sort of thing. And he was known for this. Yet at the same time, you know, he's got this reputation as being an able, brave young officer. And he's willing to take all these risks. Very, very courageous. I don't really know that much about the Crimean War. I mean, they say here there was this ideological conflict between Russian autocracy and British democracy. I think what they really mean there is the Russian monarchy, because Russia was a monarchy and Britain was a constitutional monarchy. So it wasn't really autocracy.
I think that there was a bit of conflict between the Russians and the British, particularly in terms of extending colonies into Central Asia, because the Russians were moving into Afghanistan and those kind of regions and down through the Caucasus at the same time that we were active in India and pushing the boundaries of the British Empire north. But also there was a certain amount of support given by the British government initially to the Ottoman Empire, who were also trying to resist the expansion of the Russian Empire. And obviously the Russians were trying to resist the expansion of the Ottoman Empire as well. And so that was kind of like the background to it. If you think about the situation, the besieging of Sevastopol was in 1855, so it's just under 60 years prior to the First World War, and already you can see with the use of trenches, etc., that the kind of warfare that we saw during the First World War was already developing during the Crimean War.
Well, that's interesting you say there about the Ottomans, because it becomes apparent later on that he's sort of working with the Ottomans. So the British were working with the Ottomans, because the Ottomans were against the Russians and against the Russian encroachment on their lands. And, of course, it was the Russians that actually helped to defeat the Ottomans in Bulgaria and freed Bulgaria. And I think some of these other European countries that had actually been under a Muslim occupation for some years. Well, for his service in the Crimea, he received the Crimean War Medal and Clasp. For the same service, he was appointed a Chevalier of the Legion of Honour by the government of France on the 16th of July 1856, and following the peace, he was attached to an international commission to mark the new border between the Russian Empire and the Ottoman Empire in Bessarabia. During time spent delineating the frontier between Ottoman Armenia and Russian Armenia, the highlight of which was tobogganing down Mount Ararat, Gordon continued surveying, mapping, and embraced the new technology of the camera to take what the Canadian historian C. Brad Fout called a series of evocative photographs of the people and landscape of Armenia. Throughout his life, Gordon was always a keen amateur photographer and was elected a fellow of the Royal Geographical Society to honour him for his Armenian photographs. He returned to Britain in late 1858 and was appointed as an instructor at Chatham before being promoted to captain on the 1st of April 1859. So we can see there that it's not all work and no play. He's going tobogganing here. He's also taken up this hobby of photography, which he is very good at, and he's involved in mapping and delineating these new borders that came about after the end of the war here. And we also see that he's been given awards by France because France was obviously must have been part of the Allies there that were fighting in the Crimean War, I would guess, as well as the Ottomans. Do you want to comment on any of this, Max?
Yeah, what you say, from what you say, Gordon was a very likable person, a very charismatic person, and part of that would have been him having a wide interest in things beyond just mere soldiering. So, although he was somebody who was sent out to help to expand and secure the British Empire, he was also at the same time taking an interest in the peoples of the areas that he occupied, or that his troops occupied, and was looking upon his duties from a scientific perspective as well, in terms of his membership of the Royal Geographical Society.
Yeah, it's very important that as well, that he took an interest in the peoples that they were occupying. He really sympathised with them and really tried to make life for them better than it was, which we will see. We get this narrative today that the British Empire was all about occupying and oppressing these people and taking what we could from them. And it's just not true. The absolute opposite of that is true. If Gordon is any example, and I think he is a good example of what the people would have been like that were involved in it. They saw these other races that they were occupying as just people that were a little bit behind us, and we were there to help them on the way to civilization and democracy, and once we had got there they could be given the rule of their democracies themselves and run their countries themselves, and that is eventually what happened after the Second World War. Well, next we get to China. Now, Gordon was intensely bored with garrison duty in Chatham, and he often wrote to the War Office, begging them to send him anywhere in the world where British arms were seeing action. And in 1860, Gordon got his wish by volunteering to serve in China during the Second Opium War. When he arrived in Hong Kong, he was disappointed to learn he was just too late for the fighting. Gordon had heard of the Taiping Rebellion long before he had set sail for China, and he was at first sympathetic towards the Taipings, who were led by the charismatic madman Hong Jiquang, who proclaimed himself to be the younger brother of Jesus Christ, and Gordon viewed them as somewhat eccentric Christians. And Gordon was also a Christian. He was a Protestant Christian, but he had his own views about it. He wasn't really part of any denomination, but he was definitely a Christian. After stopping in Shanghai, Gordon visited the Chinese countryside and was appalled at the atrocities committed by the Taipings against the local peasants, writing to his family that he would love to smash this cruel army with its desolating presence that killed without mercy. He arrived at Tianjin in September 1860 and was present at the occupation of Beijing and at the destruction of the Summer Palace. And the destruction of the Summer Palace was actually by us. Gordon agreed with Lord Elgin that after the Chinese had killed a group of British and French officers travelling under a white flag to Pali, that a reprisal was in order. But they called the burning of the beautiful Summer Palace vandal-like, and he told his sister in a letter it made one's heart sore to incinerate it. And I'll just stop there because that reminds me of Flavius Josephus, and when he is talking about the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, it weren't the Jews that were upset, it was the Romans. And there were tears in the Romans' eyes while this temple was being destroyed, because it was such a magnificent piece of architecture. And you got the same thing going on here. The British feel terrible about doing this, but there had to be reprisals because these savages had killed the British and French officers who were travelling under a white flag to a peace conference. So there had to be a reprisal. And it gives you an idea of what these people were like. And the British were there to keep law and order, not, oppressing these people, but protecting them from these savage Taipings, who he called a cruel army with a desolating presence. Do you want to comment on that, Max?
No, I think actually you've said about all that can usefully be said there. It is clear that Gordon has, as we've already established, got this wider concern than just mere soldiering. You know, if he was just involved in soldiering, he wouldn't really be that worried about the destruction of cultural icons in the way that the Summer Palace was. And he wouldn't really be that bothered about the cruelty being inflicted by one tribal group in China against another tribal group. But the very fact that he was concerned about these things shows that his regards for the work that he, or his regard for the work that he had to do, was much wider than as I say, just mere soldiering, and he was saw himself in a kind of humanitarian role.
Yeah, so what he was doing there was protecting the people, not oppressing the people. When they got to Jiangsu province, Staveley was requested to appoint a British officer to command the contingent, and he selected Gordon, who had been made a brevet major in December 1862, with the nomination being approved by the British government. Given the former officer Burgervine's alcoholism, open corruption, and tendency to engage in acts of mindless violence when drunk, the Chinese wanted a man of good temper, of clean hands, and a steady economist as his replacement. These requirements led Staveley to choose Gordon. Lee, the governor of the province, was impressed with Gordon, writing, "It is a direct blessing from heaven, the coming of this British Gordon. He is superior in manner and bearing to any of the foreigners whom I have come into contact with, and does not show outwardly that conceit which makes most of them repugnant in my sight. What an elixir for a heavy heart to see this splendid Englishman fight. If there is anything that I admire nearly as much as the superb scholarship of Zheng Guofan, it is the military qualities of this fine officer. He is a glorious fellow, with his many faults, his pride, his temper, and his never-ending demand for money, but he is a noble man, and in spite of all I have said to him or about him, I will ever think most highly of him. He is an honest man, but difficult to get on with." So he's been quite fair there, because he's also pointing out some of these negative things as well, his temper, his pride. And I don't understand this, his never-ending demand for money, though, because we will see later on that it's the opposite of that, really. Perhaps he was giving some of that away to charity.
Perhaps he was just making demands for money to finance the further, to finance his future expeditions, etc.
Well, actually, I think it was to finance the troops.
Yeah.
I think it was probably to finance the troops. Gordon was honest and incorruptible, and unlike many Chinese officers, did not steal the money that was meant to pay his men, but rather insisted on paying the ever-victorious army on time and in full. Gordon's insistence on paying his men meant that he was always pressing the imperial government for money, something which often irritated the mandarins, who did not understand why Gordon did not just let his men loot and plunder as a compensation for wages, like the Chinese did. Gordon quickly won the respect of his troops and made a point of treating prisoners of war well in order to encourage the Taipings to surrender, and many of his men were actually former Taipings who had chosen to enlist in the ever-victorious army. So again, we see here that he's got a much better reputation than the actual Chinese, and the Chinese were just looting and plundering, whereas Gordon wouldn't have that, and he wouldn't allow any of his men to do that, and the Chinese officers were annoyed at that, because it meant they had to actually pay wages. So he sets a good example. Do you want to add anything?
Well, it's just that I think that it is this this decline in the values of Chinese society that made China vulnerable to the expansion of Western nations during this period. I think if you go back in history and you look at the Chinese civilization, you can go back 2,000 or 3,000 years and you can find instances where really superb engineering works were undertaken by the Chinese, which, you know, some of which were later copied by Europeans when they first visited China. And it's clear from all of the cultural trappings, the music, etc., and the forms of dance that exist in the East, that the Chinese were a culture-bearing race, and they had invented gunpowder before it was known about in Europe, but unfortunately just used the gunpowder for making fireworks to amuse children with, rather than using it for martial purposes. And you know what is described here of Chinese officers keeping the money that was that should have been used to pay their men, and then just letting their men loot and pillage, that illustrates the kind of decadence that had overtaken Chinese society, that weakened it and made it therefore, as I say, vulnerable to Western expansion.
Do you think maybe when they were at the height of it, that was around the time of Marco Polo?
Yes, certainly. Yeah, that's right. And so one of the things, one of the lessons of history, basically, is that if you have a large empire and you then turn away from the values and the principles that created that empire, and you allow the empire then to descend into decadence, that your empire then becomes ripe for other outside groups to take advantage of. And to an extent, that's what we're seeing as far as Britain is concerned, as a result of us giving away the British Empire, and what other European countries are seeing as a result of allowing their empires to be lost as well. And once the empires have gone, then the countries which were the fountain of inspiration for those empires, those countries then become decadent, and we see all of the sort of things that we're seeing today in Britain and in Europe that are destructive as far as our nation is concerned. There is a lesson that we didn't learn from the Chinese, and that we need to learn very quickly now.
Yeah, I think if the men from the British Empire could see the state of Britain today, they would be so shocked that all these sort of things are going on, that when they went out in the British Empire, they went out to India and China and the rest of these places to prevent these things from happening. And I think he's really showing true British values here, a just day's pay for a just day's work, and sticking to what's right and what's just, rather than looting and pillaging. And Gordon was quite critical of the way Chinese generals fought the war, observing that the Chinese were willing to inflict and accept gargantuan losses in battle, an approach Gordon disapproved of, writing, "The great thing is to cut off their retreat, and the chances are they will go without trouble, but attack them in the front and leave their rear open, and they fight most desperately." Gordon always preferred to outflank the Taiping lines rather than to take them on frontally, an approach that caused much tension with his counterparts in the Chinese Imperial Army, who did not share Gordon's horror at the huge numbers of dead caused by frontal assaults. So Gordon's got more care for his men than the Chinese Imperial Army did for their men. And a lot of this army, this ever-victorious army, they were the Chinese. So Gordon, the white British man, has actually got more care for the Chinese than the leaders of the Chinese Imperial Army have. In its last years, the Taiping movement had oppressed the Chinese peasantry, and during a final battle where Gordon appeared on an armoured paddle steamer armed with a 32-pound cannon on the bow and followed by a fleet of 80 junks converted to gunboats, Chinese peasants emerged from their homes to cut down and hack to death the fleeing Taipings, and Gordon was hailed as a liberator by the ordinary Chinese people. So we see this: it wasn't just the leaders of the army that were like this, it was the Chinese peasantry as well. You know, they hacked all these people to death as soon as they had the chance. They're quite savage. The ever-victorious army was entirely a mercenary force whose only loyalty was to money, and whose men were interested in fighting only in order to gain the chance to plunder. Gordon felt very uncomfortable commanding this force, and at one point had to order the summary execution of one of his officers when the latter tried to take the ever-victorious army over to the Taipings, who had offered a generous bribe for switching sides. Gordon had to impose strict discipline on the ever-victorious army and worked hard to prevent the army from engaging in its tendency to loot and mistreat civilians. The mercenaries of the ever-victorious army, comprising some of the worst social elements of China, Britain, and the United States, were notorious for this practice. Whenever they marched into a new district, they would steal everything while raping all the women, leading Gordon to ensure that those officers accused of looting and or rape were summarily shot. He also had the pleasure of defeating Burgervine, the former officer who Gordon replaced, whom Gordon detested, who had raised a mercenary force and joined the Taipings. After Gordon had surrounded Burgervine's force outside of Suzhou, the latter had abandoned his own men and attempted to rejoin the Imperial side, leading Gordon to arrest him and send him to the American consul in Shanghai, together with a letter asking that Burgervine be expelled from China. Surprised he didn't have him summarily shot. Do you want to add comments to that, Max?
Well, yeah, I'm surprised he didn't have him summarily shot as well. Yeah, I mean, this is really a continuation of the last point you made, really, where Gordon is exhibiting the finest traits of the British nation, and it's where, you know, had he been somebody who was just motivated by his own glory, you could almost imagine him in a situation where he could lead the ever victorious army to a final victory and declare himself the king of China or something like that, because he's the sort of man who is exhibiting the kind of characteristics that one would hope to see in a monarch. And I think that is why the troops followed him and felt better disposed towards him than they did their own Chinese leaders, and why the Chinese peasants, when they were being liberated from the Taipings, also had that same point of view.
Yeah, a lot of charisma and bravery. He cared about his people. He just set a really good example. As Gordon travelled up and down the Yangtze River Valley, he was appalled by the scenes of poverty and suffering he saw, writing in a letter to his sister, "The horrible furtive looks of the wretched inhabitants hovering around one's boats haunts me, and the knowledge of their want of nourishment would sicken anyone. They are like wolves. The dead lie where they fall and are in some cases trodden quite flat by passers-by." The suffering of the Chinese people strengthened Gordon's faith, as he argued that there had to be a just, loving God who would one day redeem humanity from all this wretchedness and misery. During his time in China, Gordon was well known and respected by friend and foe alike for leading from the front and going into battle armed only with his rattan cane. Gordon always refused to carry a gun or a sword, a choice of weapon that almost cost him his life several times. Gordon's bravery in battle, his string of victories, apparent immunity to bullets, and his intense, blazing blue eyes led many Chinese to believe that Gordon had supernatural powers and had harnessed the Qi, the mystical life force traditionally believed in China, to govern everything in some extraordinary way. So again, we can see just what a state these Chinese people are in. Wretched inhabitants, the dead lie where they fall, they need nourishing, they're in a terrible state, and the British feelings towards that is, we want to help these people, we want to protect them from whatever it is that's causing this, we want to bring these people civilization, we want to bring them trade. Don't forget, this is during the Opium Wars as well, so we're selling this opium to these Chinese, but the people that were actually doing that and forcing the opium on the Chinese were like this guy Gordon here, you know, just wanting the best for them and wanting them to have the benefit of trade and the benefit of civilization. Do you want to comment on his description of the Chinese here, Max?
Well, not necessarily his description of the Chinese, more the probably the description of the description of him by the Chinese, the fact that they felt he had harnessed the Qi, and that's what one would expect, where you have people who've perhaps been raised in ignorance and who then suddenly see somebody who is who so fulsomely exhibits the qualities of a monarch, it's also interesting the fact that he never carried a gun or a sword. The sort of rattan cane is the, I would assume, would have been what would have been described at the time as a swagger stick. A lot of British Army officers used to carry it as a short stick that's a bit small, a bit shorter than a walking stick, but superficially looked a bit like a walking stick, which was called a swagger stick. And these are kind of symbolic of the mace that a king would carry, a mace. And obviously the queen has a mace that she held in her hand when she was crowned. Also other people that in position of authority would have a mace handed to them. But obviously for everyday use, the mace wouldn't be a large ornate thing that made of gold or something of that sort, which would be very heavy and difficult to carry around. But the stick would be more symbolic. And so, as I say, army officers used to carry these swagger sticks around that that they presumably could use to strike somebody with, but it would be more for shock value than for anything else.
And more a symbol of his authority.
That's right.
This is the main man. Treat him with respect. He's not somebody that you want to shoot. And if you take him prisoner, he needs to be treated well as an officer and all the rest of it, because even when you're fighting against another army, you have the respect for your enemy. If he's a formidable foe, you have respect for him, and this is the man leading them. And like a mace or a scepter, like the royal scepter that he was carrying there.
Yes.
Well, Gordon then reorganized his force and advanced against Kunshan, which was captured at considerable loss before also capturing the city of Suzhou in November. After its surrender, Gordon personally guaranteed that any Taiping rebel who laid down his arms would be humanely treated. But the ever-victorious army had been ordered not to enter Suzhou, and only imperial forces entered the city. Gordon was thus powerless when the imperial forces executed all of the Taiping POWs, an act that enraged him. A furious Gordon wrote that executing prisoners of war was stupid, writing, "If faith had been kept, there would have been no more fighting, as every town would have given in." In China, the penalty for rebellion was death, and under the Chinese system of familial responsibility, all family members of a rebel were equally guilty, even if they had nothing to do with the rebellious individual's acts. The Mandarins were thus much inclined to execute not only Taipings, but also their spouses, children, parents, and siblings, as being all equally guilty of treason. Gordon believed this approach was militarily counterproductive, as it encouraged the Taipings to fight to the death, which Gordon felt to be very unwise, as the Taiping leader, Hong Jiquan, had become murderously paranoid, conducting bloody purges of his followers. Many Taipings were willing to surrender, if only the imperial government would spare the lives of themselves and their families. Even more importantly, Gordon had given his word of honour that all of the Taipings who surrendered would be well treated, and he regarded the massacre as a stain on his honour. Again, we can see that these are really savage peoples, really, killing the spouses, the children, the parents, and the siblings. They're all guilty, equally guilty of treason. This is the sort of thing that was going on. This is what these people were like, and the British were over there to prevent this. And also,
what it also shows, though, is that the imperial Chinese were little better, really, than the Taipings, because of their sort of murderous tendency in this sort of situation, where a desire for revenge outweighs the good sense that Gordon exhibited in. Stating that if you allow people to surrender under those circumstances and you treat them well once they've surrendered, then it will encourage more people to surrender as well, which would then make the overall job much easier. And that once you conduct a massacre of people, then you know that any future Taipings in a similar situation are going to fight to the bitter end.
Not very good at strategy, were they, this Chinese Imperial Army? They just wanted a full frontal assault. We don't care how many people are killed, and we're not interested in strategy at all. So you can see why Gordon was such a difference to the rest. And I can understand he would have been really, really furious at that they had not honoured his pledge. I mean, he had made that promise.
But this again is a feature of of what happens when empires become decadent, where people who are totally unfit for authority get appointed to positions of authority based upon cronyism and things of that sort, and therefore do things that are just totally illogical and counterproductive.
That's what
we see in Britain today with the handling of the coronavirus.
Yeah, it's a serious thing, you know, an oath as well. And he had given them his oath, and the Chinese weren't prepared to respect that. But on the 1st of January 1864, Gordon was informed that a messenger from the Tongzhi Emperor was coming to see him and that he should put on his finest uniform. When the Emperor's messenger arrived, he had with him servants carrying boxes of silver coins, numbering 10,000 in total, together with banners written in the most eloquent calligraphy, celebrating Gordon as a great general, and a letter from the Emperor himself, written in the best calligraphy on yellow silk, thanking Gordon for taking Suzhou and offering all these presents as rewards. Gordon refused all the gifts and wrote on the Emperor's silk message, "Major Gordon receives the approbation of His Majesty the Emperor with every gratification, but regrets most sincerely that owing to the circumstances which occurred since the capture of Suzhou, he is unable to receive any mark of His Majesty the Emperor's recognition." The Emperor was much offended when he received Gordon's message at the Forbidden City, and Gordon's military career in China was then effectively over for a time. During his time with the ever-victorious army, Gordon had won 33 battles in succession, but wrote a letter home that his losses were no joke, as 48 of his 100 officers and about 1,000 of the 3,500 soldiers had been killed or wounded in action. So he's really a man of his word here. He's not going to take a bribe from the emperor to back down on this. You know, killing those prisoners of war after he had given his word, that was just not on. And again, I think this is an example of British fibre, British values, isn't it? These are real British values. You know, not taking a bribe and setting an example like this. We should probably leave it here, but I'll just ask you, you know, have you got anything else that you'd like to add to this before we finish, Max?
No, just to repeat what you've just said, really, that this is this sort of rigorous standing on matters of principle is one of the things that made people like Gordon stand out from the people around them.
It's something that made Britain stand out, isn't it? That's what Britain was known for sticking to principles and keeping to their word. There was a time when we had a very, very good reputation throughout the world, particularly throughout the Third World. Not that you would believe it today with the people that attack the British Empire and run it down. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Max.
That's great. It's my pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.